So I'm here to present on Linofogarty, obviously. So I brought a lot of pictures because from years of presenting on PRIN, you're never supposed to talk about them as a person. And I like to have, I don't know, I think it's nice to have Lionel here talking about or smiling down on us. So I'm here to present on a poet who subverts the historical, linguistic, formal categories evoked in the creation and maintenance of a mono-historicizing nationalism. I want to discuss the role of Linofogarty in the development of Black aesthetics, and in doing so, I aim to build a case for redefining the place of experimental Indigenous writing in Australia, and to investigate and resituate Fogarty's innovative poetics, which I feel have been equally fetishized, dismissed, or assimilated into easy arguments, and thereby devalued in their position within Australian literature. This project, this is the opening kind of gambit for, so it's probably a very long crescendo, aims to explicate what I feel to be the downfall of categorizing Fogarty's innovative poetics into a discourse based solely on post-colonial theory or of activist poetics, and also the naivety with which we say Fogarty uses his words as weapons. Following Evie Shockley's argument in Renegade Poetics, I want to progress beyond a critical stance reliant upon a vision of Australian literature which treats race as the single arbiter in defining the points at which language, creativity, politics, and cultural life intersect. To contextualize this more broadly, we would never say of Celan that he uses his language as a weapon. And we would never commit to this statement because it is performed in accuracy, which willfully ignores the subtlety and nuance through which Celan, or in this case Fogarty, engages with the world. As with Celan, Fogarty has the language of his oppressor as his creative tongue. His knowledge and employment of other nation languages, which I'll use in place of dialects, which obviously has some negative connotations, and the manner in which these nation languages intersect with the mythopoeia of country is imperative to the reading and writing of his cultural world. However, beyond the creolization of community language and the forced transculturations this usage implies, Fogarty's family life, education, love life, and political activism has been predominantly written in English. So it stands to reason that a writer with a career spanning over 35 years expects more of language than weaponry. So this structuralist binary pronouncement is indicative of the critical treatment which traditionally demarks innovative Indigenous writing as outside of the historical and privileged categorizations of Australian literary history. And I'm really kind of grateful to see that this is slowly being broken down this weekend. To this end, my aim is to provide a bridging structure through which we can situate Fogarty's writing in a relational network of literary antecedents. So I bring up kind of Black Panther poetry in terms of some of his early work, as well as Black Arts Movement stuff, thinking like Etheridge Knight in these kind of instructional poems to his grandchildren. As well as historically relational poetic movements, which represent a reaction to and codification beyond the confines of colonization. So thinking Derek Walcott, Brathwaite, those kind of poets. This paper does not seek to dissolve the primary interconnectedness between the political and the cultural, but seeks to instead to respect the symbolism, mythology, and cultural iconography of Fogarty's roots in adding to his poetic, and to examine his linguistic expression as a process, cognizant of its aesthetic and theoretic ramifications. In breaking Fogarty's language down into its constituent parts, and analyzing the poem's ability to measure, gauge, and record through the processes of hybridization, we might gain insight by recognizing this language as polysituated within current conceptions of theoretic, linguistic, and transcultural poetic discourses. That's obviously Lionel and Gary from an interview that I did with, sort of in conjunction with the both of them last year at RMIT. One of the easiest manners in which to expose this facile expression, his words are weapons, or he's a guerrilla poet, is to examine the semantic and semiotic compossibility of Creole expression within Fogarty's work. Glissant, as Peter was talking about yesterday, using glissant, argues that at its highest aim, literature combines two ontological functions. The first represents the demythification of the subject, And I take this to mean the decentralizing of the authorial eye, which we all have heard more than enough about, I'm sure. And the second, as is evidenced through Fogarty's use of Creole, the creation of a hallowing effect representing a unification of community around its mythic beliefs, history, and its ideologies. Reading Fogarty through a modernist or late modernist relational poetics enforces the demythified status of the poetic eye. However, and this is inherently problematic when analyzing writing within this kind of colonial horizon, right, is that we're dealing with someone who, in his lifetime, was a historically constituted subject, denied the rights of citizenship, denied humanity, basically. So, to avoid any essentializing frameworks around the authorial subject, we must consider Fogarty's inclusion of indigenous languages from across Australia, because he uses multiple, as an evocation of presence, a multiplication and strengthening of voice. Fogarty's use of Creole is a lingua non posse, or a non-situated language. The inclusion of this non-situated language, displaced and almost eradicated by colonization, is an evocation of the narratives of country, which instill a sense of common origin, a reinforcement of Aboriginal unity beyond dispersal and beyond the genocide of settlement. Fogarty's creolization breaks down the unitary subject and, following Glissant, reinforces the centrality of a collective mythos within literature's ontological expression. Given these functions, the intermediary voice in Fogarty is a position of slippage between the personal and public, between the singular and the collective, a position which reinforces the nexus between the political and the literary. As the poem She Sang reads, "We are like tunes sung out of songs. We are hostile that bring light, life, and color. To cling to custom, to uphold our rights, you and I come to dance. We are many several hundred faces, yet we can't properly see your face." This connection is also detailed through the depiction of size, where the scope and dimension of the represented subject connotes a correlative relationship between the individual and the histories of country. As Fogarty writes on living on tribal lands, "Here I'm immense in silence," or in Bureau codes, "Unframed reality felt enormous, framed inside much more, great spirits, big seeds, breathing sounds of sunlight." So the socio-spiritual connection to country that Fogarty depicts in the poem is an expansion of the personal register to include the mythological and colonial timeframes as histories through which personal stories are written. So one way to demark the function of Fogarty's poetics is to assess registers and representations of voice as a measure of scale, and to use this position for establishing the divide between personal and the public voice, between the authorial and the atemporal frames of his writing. This multiplicity is a conscious destructuring of the categories of subjective confinement, an argument against the subject as historically constituted. The inclusive synthesis expressed in "we are many several hundred faces" defies any outside categorization and utilizes polyvocality to represent a historic plurality of expression. So the main example of which I want to talk about, which can highlight this kind of multi-temporal frame, is Disguise Not Attitude, which you just had an introduction to from Michael. So. Disguise Not Attitude. Distance is run, sport to a tested vessel, wander over teams, sailing with economics in mind. Absorbed, unlawfully driving juvenile delinquency, they appeared, wrenching survival. Peered, bent, engulfed dominances, inching, advising, achieving came relieved into social skills. The pride fosters no interest in developed tradition, walks her texture of eternity. Pedestals are matched cries in the wind. Verdant rainbow shapes, now mass rustling to shrieks. A star, relaxed, when fell upon this globe. So the poem's opening of tested vessels immediately brings to mind colonial fleets sailing with economics in mind. Distances run sport and driving juvenile delinquency, counterpoint contrasting positions of oppression from colonial to contemporary times, juxtaposing the slaughter of indigenous groups during colonization with present incarceration rates. Wrenching Survival speaks to those struggling under layers of systemic oppression where achieving is registered against non-indigenous values. That the female subject has decided to walk her texture of eternity speaks to the capacity for indigenous rituals and rites along lines of Peter's phrase, totemic geography, to recenter the world. The poignant choice of rustling in Now Mass Rustling to Shriek provides a stark contrast to the rustling of cattle and operations of controlled movement and containment enforced upon indigenous communities. The long slurred syllables of eternity in Walks Her Texture of Eternity produces a vocable depth echoing spatial and subjective awareness. And this is counterpointed with the rustling to shrieks with its compacted vocables. Reading the stanza, one gains an awareness of the polysituated state of Fogarty's language, blending contemporary, mythopoeic, and colonial time frames, and reflecting the manner in which the poetic frame can be both enlarged to include the mythopoeic and contracted to include just one individual. I would posit that the intermediary voice within Disguise Not Attitude represents the historic utterance Philip Meade calls for. It's kind of nerve-wracking when these people are all in the audience. Philip, you can pick me up on this later if I'm wrong. When he asked for the fundamental redefinition of Australian antiquity and modernity along the temporal axis, and of space and place along the spatial one. In arguing on the scope and scale of the subject in the poetry of Charles Olson, which, again, Peter has used in this notion of this relational framework, which we talk about, bringing mythopoesis into the present. So Keston Sutherland argues that about Olson's desire to be the human immense enough to be in that world, unexappropriated of its native mythopoesis and all its history, to find a position in which the human and the universe are held together in radical commensuration. Poetry, Sutherland concludes, is the language of making that bond of care. The intermediary voice in Fogarty represents just such a position. The voice represents a nodal point, and it's a projective nodal point, of course, of the temporal and lingual syncretism poised to make a new order. In the creative junction between poesis and ethos, Peter Minter argues, is a projective structure which is both sensational and immediately genealogical and records an event appearing simultaneously upon vectors of interiority and exteriority. And I believe that this represents the origin of the problem with deciphering the questions of address in Fogarty's writing. The subjective voice has the scope to expand to include projections of cultural and historical knowledge, thus representing a position of centrality and cohesion within the community. The voice in Fogarty is polysituated, and in the process of writing, he has a means by which to determine where and how the subjective voice is translocated in regards to the spatial-temporal axes of the poem. An indeterminate possessive status and its ambiguous relation to multiple historic times evidences this polysituated speaking voice. This polyvocality entails both assumptions and limitations. The we, used in Fogarty's communally voiced poems, is a projective voice of multiple, distinct, yet historic subjects. It is a reinforcement of Glossin's reunification function of literature, not a deferral to a transcendent voice. The historic range of this voice gives added credence to the cultural right to tell one's own stories, as the poem Fuck Off argues. I don't need a Nyandi in the year 2001. Forsake for fate is forsake. Let's end the church-minded people in cities. Let's all go back to the dreamtime reality. Let my people, community, a relation to our seeds. Deep down in the black anthropological mind lives a historic process you all here never will rewrite. In that this language is seen to contravene the grammatical and syntactical constraints of English language usage, speaks to the forced transculturation of enforced English in Aboriginal community schools, but also represents an aesthetic of disobedience, as appears later in Disguise Not Attitude, Handout Confluence Mortgages Instructed, Your Asserted Civil Recite History Piled Together Hesitationally, Then Wooden Taboos Won't Case Mistaken Places, or From Literary Embarrassed, Flights Stain Divinity Sciences, Now Damnation Diffused, Solar Metrical, Gave Us Observed Grandeurs, Now Tempest Horrible Recedes, or Interpretation by Question Monologue. Given the multiple and overlaying points of address and the emphasis on each in a given poem, Fogarty's poems must speak in multiple registers so as to search for the intactness and independence of voice against the flow of cultural input his poems measure. If, as Kinsella argues, the use of English standards in Fogarty represents a recognition, interaction with, and qualification of a particular English historicity, Fogarty's syntactical and grammatical traits represent non-compliance, a willful disobedience to conform to patterns of Australian English, with a poetic voice that is multifarious, that is transpositional, cyclic, declarative, a or multi-temporal, metaphoric and metonymic at once. Given it is a poetics with a symbolism, mythology, and iconography that falls outside the cultural experience of many readers, this in itself does not yield weaponry. To plane this complexity to the level of weaponry is a latent excuse for critical non-engagement. The asyntactic, disobedient languages of the poem aren't unique to Fogarty. Lines such as long way haunting, which is like just a stunning line which is always kind of with me, or wrenching survival, peered bent and gulf dominances, are not structurally different than truck out black, blue shaken front by a twig blurred, which is a prin line, which again is one of those ones that makes no sense but sticks with you forever. These non-syntactic lines work to make us reconsider the possibilities of English language usage. The categorization of Fogarty's linguistic innovation as weapon is essentializing and is due to the fetishized condition of Indigenous literary arts and bears no relation to a reading of the non-syntactic experimentation undertaken in his work. I would argue that we consider reading Fogarty's poetic as a processional practice, which is something Stuart talked about the other day, for the manner in which it witnesses and records events of forced transculturation and functions within the parameters of an experimental literature which we can loosely call black aesthetics. Fogarty's intermediary voice is at once understood as an a priori cultural projection, a poem which records a disobedient historicity and speaks to notions of Australian Indigenous culture and history through the ethical inclusion of archives of character, genealogies of cultural memory, histories of the present. Fogarty's expression of a polysituated subject represents an inclusion of symbolic mythopoeia, which reinforces Glissant's idea that capital H history is fissured by other histories. The erasure of Indigenous stories from the narrative of Australia exposes the divorce between reality and monohistoricization. Breaking the privilege of rhetoric's hold on Australian literary history is a black aesthetic through which Fogarty insists upon the centrality of Indigenous voices to national history, even in the face of erasure. For Glissant, these voices represent the sense of fragmentation and diversity that replace the falsifying symmetry of history as linear progress. That is, to differentiate between the totalizing impulse of transcendent history, capitals, and the shapeless historical diversity. In this way, Fogarty's experimental poetics expresses the centrality of a personal and collective experience of indigeneity, which echoes a familiar plaintiff. Either I am nobody, or I am a nation.